Calling it to order. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd. Let the record reflect. The time is 6 p.m. Today we have present Senator Michicki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Hughes. Please silence or turn off your cell phone. Thank you to Nancy, Taylor, and Regina for assisting us today. We have three items on the agenda. The committee will be given an introduction and taken through a sectional analysis of HB 12, protective order sponsored by Representative Kopp. We have a committee substitute for that bill that will be introduced, and then we'll open and close public testimony this evening on that. We will then have an initial bill introduction to SB 80, Initiative Severability, sponsored by Senator Birch. And finally, we'll take up the last portion of the meeting to go through an explanation of the changes for Senate Bill 52, Alcohol Beverage Control, Alcohol Regulation from Senator Michicki, as Senator Keel requests an explanation of the changes from the original bill to the current substitute. I'd ask committee members to keep your questions and comments focused on the items, always concise questions and thoughtful brevity. I'd like to invite Representative Kopp and his staff, Kendrick, to the table, please. Welcome, gentlemen, to Senate Judiciary. Please place your names on the record and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, representative for District 24. I have with me here my staff, Mr. Ken Truitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp.
So, Madam Chair, one of the habits I still carry with me after retiring from my law enforcement days is I read Supreme Court opinions and rulings as they come out. And this last August, one struck me. It was in the case Whalen versus Whalen, where the Supreme Court said in a matter of a request to extend and renew domestic violence protective orders that it was not clear in our statutes that they could extend an order based on an incident of violence that they had already ruled on. In other words, if they had already given you a protective order and you were still afraid of your perpetrator, that it was not clear whether or not they could give you an extension or a renewal. And they said that our statutes were defective. And when I looked into it and checked with various attorneys and folks that are in the courts every day, I personally was unfamiliar with the courts not routinely extending protective orders. And we were able to learn that that was, in fact, the case the courts normally had. If someone came in and requested an extension or a renewal, granted that extension or renewal without requiring a person to be a victim a second time before the court could rule on that. So what we have done, Madam Chair, in this case is we have looked at our two protective order statutes, one that deals with domestic violence and the other that deals with sexual assault and stalking, and have provided clarifying language that a protective order may be renewed or extended prior to the either 30 days prior to the ending of the order or within 60 days after it expires, without a person having to become a victim a second time. That, in other words, the court doesn't need to say, did something else happen to you that would justify this? And how this routinely comes up, Madam Chair, is a person may be arrested for domestic violence assault. They go to jail, and the last thing they tell their victim is, when I get out, we're going to settle this. I'm coming after you. Or still very angry, and the person, now it's 6 months later, the person's getting out, and the victim says, Judge, I'm still very much afraid. This person pointed a gun at me, and they said they're coming after me, and I believe them and then, and I believe them now, and may I please have an extension or a renewal? And according to our Supreme Court, they said our statutes do not make that clear, that it's authorized unless we can point to another example of domestic violence that they can rule on and say, yes, you may have an extension or a renewal. So it just seemed wrong, and it seemed it was inconsistent with how the courts had been responding to those. So House Bill 12 does not introduce any new public policy. It simply corrects the statutes to expressly allow the extension or renewal of those orders. Another branch of government, our Supreme Court, has asked us to do this, and that's in the spirit of that we bring this forward to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Cobb. And let the record reflect that Senator Reinbold joined us a few minutes ago. Mr. Truitt, do you have anything you'd like to add, or would you like to go through a sectional analysis?
I can jump right to the sectional, if it's okay. Your pleasure, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
So this is a fairly straightforward, simple bill. I think our interest in going through the sectional is putting on record exactly how the fix to the Supreme Court's, the problems that the Supreme Court identified, how this bill corrects those. So we'll just take it straight at the top. Section 1, we're starting with the sexual assault and stalking protective order statute. You can see lines 4 through 6. That's the existing language of the existing statute. And the language on line 5 is conforming language for what comes next. A couple of things to point out. The statute as it exists right now, subsection E only applies to sexual assault, does not apply to stalking. And that's important for our explanation of the changes. I'll kind of walk through how this bill has changed since it was introduced. You see on line 7, it starts with the language, the stalking or.
Just to be sure, are you working off of version E?
/ E, yes.
Okay,
yes,
thank you. Continue, please.
I guess I should say for the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Cobb. So on line 7, the language, the stalking or, that was not in the original bill as it was introduced. That was a committee substitute out of State Affairs introduced that language. And that is because Section 2 is the operative fix to the Whelan problem. That is the section that starts with the solution to what the Whelan Court introduced or identified for us. And just briefly, I'll draw your attention to line 14, the phrase, or extended under this section. Kind of those two provisions are the operative fixes to the Whelan issue. Starting on lines 9 through 11, this is a new concept, but it's new because it was introduced by the Whelan Court. It's precisely the situation that Representative Kopp referenced. So the person coming to the court, the perpetrator of the domestic violence might be in jail, so there's no need to issue a protective order, but the judge could say, well, I believe there was domestic violence here, but since the perpetrator is behind bars, there's no need to enter a protective order. Or there could be variations of that, such as between the time the petition was filed and between the court hearing, the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator may have moved out of state or to a different city or somewhere else to where they were not in close proximity to the victim. There could be a finding of domestic violence, but the court saying, because the proximity of the perpetrator and the victim don't lend themselves to a need for protective order, I find there's no need to enter protective order. So prior to Whelan, the judge would just say, come back if the situation changes and we'll give you a protective order. But after Whelan, that option's no longer available. So that's why number 3 is a new concept, but it's a new concept that was highlighted by the Whelan decision. Section 2 provides for the courts just the process and the due process for how an extension will be handled. Before I go on, at the very end of line 10 and all of line 11, starting on line 10 with the language, if the petition alleges a change in circumstance since the court's previous finding, that was language introduced in the House or the other body's Judiciary Committee as their committee substitute. And the court system requested that, and for our purposes, the change in circumstance would be the perpetrator getting out of jail or the perpetrator moving back to the locale where the victim would be located. So Section 2 contains really just all the due process and the process provisions of how a court would administer an extension under this. You can see that within 30 days before the expiration or 60 days after it expires, a person can request the protective order. Notice is given to the to the respondent, and then the court still has to make a finding on the request for the extension. The extension's not automatic. There's nothing in this section or the bill that really touches the existing burden of proof that applies to these protective orders, so that there's really, there are no proposed changes to how a court is going to rule on this or the burden that the petitioner bringing the request has to meet. I'll take a pause there. And moving on to Section 3, we get into the actual domestic violence protective order. And I would say the next two sections have the identical intent as the prior two, but they're not identical because the domestic violence protective order statute is not identical to the sexual assault and stalking protective order. Section 3 is really identical to Section 1, but it applies to the domestic violence protective order statute. What is different in Section 4, which is the same basic operative and procedural provisions that are in Section 2, is that if you look on lines 19 and specifically 20, this particular provision or option only applies to protective orders issued under Section B2 of the Domestic Violence Protective Order Statute. And in that statute, there are two categories of protective orders. B1 contains the what's commonly known as the long-term protective order statute, where there's no end date on that. It's perpetual until the court lifts the protective order or otherwise decides to dissolve it. Section B2 contains 16 different provisions of the way the protective order or reasons a protective order can be issued or relief that the court can issue by way of a protective order, and this bill applies to those provisions, not the long-term protective order. Finally, Section 5 is just the applicability, and it just makes clear that if this were to be enacted into law, that all the operative provisions, Sections 1, 2, 3, and 4, apply to basically every protective order that's in existence, protective orders that would get issued on the day that this law would go into effect, and then protective orders issued in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Truitt. Are there any questions of the sponsor, Senator Reinbold?
And that's the one question my staff and I looked through this bill, and they pointed out there wasn't an exact effective date. So do you want to put an effective date in here, or do you want to just wait until it passes and the 90 days passed?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it's a great question. What's that?
Is it Senator?
Oh, Senator. Senator Reinbold, I'm sorry, old habits. Senator Reinbold, that's a good question. So the I guess the automatic effective date, you're right, would be 90 days after it was passed. I don't have a strong preference. It would be nice to have it be effective as immediately as possible. It would help a lot of people. So you raise a good point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Michiki? You're good? All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. And I do want to say that I appreciate the fact that you do spend some time reading cases in your spare time, because you did. Reading the Whalen case, it was clear it would be it's not right that someone would have to experience and be victimized a second time in order to get the protective order extended. So thank you for highlighting that and filing this bill to take care of that. Do you have any closing comments before we're going to bring up the committee substitute here in a minute?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say we worked with the Alaska Legal Services Corporation and the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault in drafting the bill, and it is supported by those agencies as well as the Alaska Peace Officers Association. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for that. Thank you for joining us today, and if you want to sit in and listen what continues here, then I'm going to ask Ms. Largen if she'd please come up to the table to go over the committee substitute. So, Senator Reinbold, may I have a motion, please?
Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for House Bill 12, Work Order 31 LS0103/G to be adopted as the working document.
And I will object for explanation of changes. So, Ms. Largent, please place your name on the record, and please walk us through the changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regina Largent, staff for Chair Hughes. And the committee substitute for House Bill 12, Work Order 31-LS10031/G, includes three simple changes from version E involving effective time changes and conforming changes. And I also wanted to restate that Christine Pate is also online from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault if there are any questions relating to the impact of these changes, that she could help with that. Section 1 amends AS 1865-850B, and this one pertains to protective orders issued for stalking or sexual assault, and makes the change from a six-month period to 1 year for the effective period. And this is putting it in line with current protective order time periods for domestic violence. Section 3 also has a conforming nature to it. It amends AS 1865-850F to provide that protective orders for stalking or sexual assault have a maximum extension period of 1 year. This section also clarifies that when an extension to a current protective order is granted, the start date of that extension is the day the current protective order would have expired. Section 5 adds a new subsection to amend AS 1866-100F to provide that extensions granted for domestic violence protective orders start on the date the current protective order would have expired.
That is it. Are there any questions, Ms. Large? Senator Michiki.
Is there anything in this bill that does not allow additional extensions of 1 year?
You mean a max? Are you talking, excuse me, through the chair, Senator Michiki, are you asking if, like the other states that have a maximum of 3, that kind of language?
No, I'm asking about whether or not this bill allows an additional extension, or is it only allowing 1 year past the first year?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, to Senator Michiki, and the bill sponsor can correct me if I'm wrong here. The way I read this is that it just provides the time frames for when it expires. In other words, this puts within 30 days before or 60 days after that you could file for another extension.
Yeah.
We'll bring the sponsor back up, and I don't believe it does. And also, he did reference long-term. I think Mr. Truitt mentioned that there are long-term protective orders also as an option for someone who would need it ongoing. But would you like to respond, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there is no limit to the renewals.
Name on the record, please.
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, Chuck Cobb, House District 24. And there is no limit to the number of renewals. The court could renew it more than once, yes.
So,
Senator Michiki?
So the initial is likely for 1 year, and then the extension is 1 year unless earlier dissolved by the court.
Through the chair, yes.
And those extensions can continue. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And while we have you up here, Mr. Sponsor, yes. Representative Kopp, mm-hmm. The suggestions for this committee substitute, can you tell us where they originated, and are you supportive of the changes?
Yes. Short answer is yes, I'm supportive. The increasing the protective order duration for sexual assault and stalking from 6 months to a year would bring it in line with domestic violence, sexual assault. And looking back at the legislative history, it appears that the reason was is domestic violence involves someone you know, and where stalking and sexual assault was kind of a mix, but more of a mix of stranger, and it didn't come up as often as far as the request for orders of protection out as long as an ongoing domestic relationship. But I think for continuity, there's a lot of good reasons to have them both be at a year, and I also know that the Domestic Violence Support Network really supports that, also them both being 1 year, and that's based on their long history of dealing with both of them, and I fully support the recommendation from the committee.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Did you have something to add, Ms. Largent?
To the chair, yes. And just for the record, also to remember that this isn't an automatic extension. When somebody files, there's an evidentiary hearing. And so the judge, even though this is allowing the option, the judge still has to make findings on the record and find by preponderance of the evidence and decide whether or not to continue. So and the defendant would have an opportunity to present evidence so that an extension would not be granted if potentially. So and in the same instance, they can file a motion at any time that the protective order is in effect. You know, a week later, 6 months later, the defendant or the person can file to have it extinguished. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Is there any further question or comment? So I'm going to remove my objection. And hearing no further objections, the committee substitute has been adopted. And at this time, I'd like to open public testimony. And so we have Christine Pate calling in from Sitka. Welcome, Ms. Pate. Identify yourself for the record and let us know what you think of HB 12, please.
Yes, thank you, Chair Hughes, Vice Chair Reinbold, and members of the committee. My name is Christine Pate. I'm the Legal Program Director for ANSA. In this capacity, I run a statewide legal services program for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And I also provide training and technical assistance to the advocates at our statewide domestic violence and sexual assault programs around the state that go into court daily with survivors on civil protection orders. We greatly appreciate Representative Kopp's work on this bill and this committee's work to make it even a stronger bill to help survivors with the remedies they need. We are very supportive of the committee substitute to increase the length of the stalking and sexual assault protection orders from 6 to 12 months. That just really gives uniformity to the law and protects survivors who are not in an intimate relationship with the opposing party and often need a much longer time period than the short time span of 6 months. So that is a great needed fix. What I do know after having done this work for 25 plus years is that civil legal protection orders are a critical tool to help end domestic violence in our state, and making sure that they are strong and flexible is critical to keeping survivors safe. This is because survivors can control the process and they have a voice in getting the remedies that they need to keep themselves and their families safe. As a civil legal provider for survivors, we've seen the devastating effect of the Whalen decision. We've heard from numerous survivors who have needed protection after histories of terrible abuse but are unable to get it. And I echo what Representative Kopp said about prior to Wayland, there was many courts in the state that allowed for an extension or allowed you to get a new protection order based on previously found domestic violence. Now courts' hands are tied, and so this bill really gives discretion back to our courts to protect those survivors that most need it. In sum, we believe that survivors who have endured terrible histories of DV are being forced currently to make impossible strategic decisions as to when to apply for a protection order so as to maximize their safety, because they know they will only have 6 or 12 months of safety. If there's a criminal case, should they wait until the defendant gets out of jail? What if there is no criminal contact order, but the provision? But what if there is a criminal no contact order, but the provisions are not specific and comprehensive enough as you can get in a civil protection order? When will that victim have to use their 6 or 12 months of safety that current Alaska law allows for? We believe these aren't the types of decisions that survivors should have to make for themselves and their families. Protection orders to be effective must respond to the cyclical nature of crimes of intimate partner violence. We urge you to approve this bill so that courts go back to having discretion to protect victims after 12 months if safety demands it. Thank you, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Pate. Are there any questions for her? Thank you, and We also have online out of Valdez, Patty Masters. Welcome to Senate Judiciary Committee. Ms. Masters, please state your name for the record and give your testimony, please, on HB 12.
Thank you, Madam Chair Hughes and Madam Vice Chair Reinbold. My name is Patty Masters, and I am with ABV Advocates for Victims of Violence, which is a domestic violence and sexual assault program. We also have a shelter. I am the direct service coordinator, and I work with survivors of DV and sexual assault on a daily basis. I support HB 12. This is very critical to help victims feel safe. Christine made just a great call to all those points, and that survivors need that option of having a protection order for longer than 1 year. It is difficult for women and men to come in to programs and ask for help, and the process can be daunting while suffering endless trauma and their situations or getting out of a violent household and lifestyle. And having that protection order for more than for a year is just so important. This bill would fix the Whelan decision by allowing the courts to grant protection orders based on already litigated domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and to extend that protection order past 1 year. I have recently worked with a couple victims that have been terrified because they their perpetrators have been incarcerated and they're getting out this month and last month, and they have been terrified that they would not be able to get a long-term protective order. So I support and just commend you all for your hard work and to promote this HB 12. So if you have any questions, let me know.
Are there any questions for Ms. Masters? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Masters, and I also want to thank Ms. Pate for the work that you do to help victims in our state. Appreciate it very much. Is there anyone, I'm not seeing anyone else online, is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. And if there's anyone also, I just try to remember when we do public testimony that you can always submit your testimony in writing to senate.judiciary@akleg.gov. And those who testify today, if you do have written comments, you're welcome to submit them. So we're going to set this bill aside at this time, and we thank the sponsor and his staff for joining us this evening. And I'd ask committee members, if you have any amendments, to please get them to my office by noon on Thursday. So now we'll move to the next agenda item. If Senator Birch would come forward and his staff, Ms. Skipper. We're going to now focus on Senate Bill 80, Initiative Severability. And if the sponsor and his staff would please introduce themselves for the record and proceed with introducing your bill.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you for hearing SB 80. For the record, my name is Senator Chris Birch, District M in South Anchorage.
Kim Skipper, staff to Senator Birch, District M.
Great. Again, thank you very much for hearing this bill. It's all six lines of it. SB 80 seeks to ensure ballot initiative language that appears before voters at the ballot box is the same as the language circulated during the signature gathering phase, and to restore the legislature's important role in the initiative process. Alaska's Constitution details a very important right of our residents. It's the right to enact legislation through the voter initiative process. The legislature also has the right to enact substantially the same legislation as proposed in the initiative, thus removing it from the ballot. Per our Constitution, some issues are off limits for ballot initiatives, and initiatives can only cover one subject. But while a cursory legal review of the language occurs before the Lieutenant Governor's certification, it has sometimes been the case that further review finds constitutional concerns with proposed language. In those cases, a party can file a lawsuit to force the issue through the court system. This can happen simultaneous to the circulation of signature booklets. Under current law, if a court determines that language in a proposed initiative is unconstitutional and or severed, an amended version of the language can appear before the voters. This results in voters seeing a different initiative than the one that they supported with their signature. Furthermore, if the courts revise or sever the language after the legislative review process, they deny the legislature the right to review the initiative as revised. The net effect of the court's severance is that an initiative can move forward to the voters that is substantially different than the initial version reviewed by the legislature. SB 80 would rectify this situation. Under this bill, if a court determines that the language in a proposed initiative is unconstitutional or severed, the lieutenant governor must reject the entire initiative petition and prohibit it from appearing on the ballot. Voters should be assured that language on the ballot has not changed from the language in the petition booklets supported with voter signatures, and further, restores the legislature's right to review and enact substantially similar legislation to stop the initiative from moving forward. Madam Chair, again, thank you for the opportunity to present SB 80, and I would appreciate the committee's support. Eric Felstad is on the line for assistance in answering any questions and to testify. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Do you have a question?
I just wanted to say that we heard this in State Affairs, and it's you worked like 6 months on the language. The language is excellent, and I am a very big supporter of this. So thank you for bringing this forth.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Skipper, do you want to add to that or do a little sectional here?
Madam Chair, Kim Skipper, for the record. There is one section of this bill, and it amends the following section. It amends AS15.45.240, section, and it adds a new subsection B. The provisions of an initiative are not severable after being circulated under AS15.45.110. An initiative petition may not contain a severability clause. If a court finds a provision of an initiative petition unconstitutional during a review under A of this section, the court shall order the lieutenant governor to reject the entire initiative petition and prohibit the placement on the ballot. It's that in a nutshell.
Okay. Thank you. I have a question. Initiative initiates new law. A referendum repeals law, existing law. So do our citizens have the ability to repeal and reenact something in the same thing, and would that be an initiative? Do you happen to know? I'm just wondering, or would that be defined as a referendum, and would we need this all to also to extend to referendums?
It's my understanding this applies specifically to initiatives, and I frankly am not entirely sure about the referendum process.
Okay, Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, there would be no need for the severability protection on a referendum. It only repeals the entire bill. So it would not apply in.
Great. I knew it wouldn't apply to a straight repeal, but I was wondering if the citizen had the ability to do a repeal and a reenactment in the same process, and if that would be an initiative, so that would fall under this. That was my question.
Yeah, we do have Eric Felstad as an attorney who has assisted us in supporting the drafting of this, and he would be available online for questions.
Okay. Yes, you are online. Mr. Felsbad, if you would, did you hear that question? If you'd introduce yourself for the record, and welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Chair, hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Felsbad. I'm an attorney in Anchorage with Perkins Coie. I'm here on my own behalf. And my practice is focused on natural resources and other issues, and I have some background, I think, as some of you know, with the initiative process that was involved in the so-called Proposition 1 last year, and so I've been around this issue for a while. I'm not sure I exactly followed the question, so if someone could repeat it, it had to do with referendums.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for joining us. An initiative initiates new law. A referendum repeals old law. I was just wondering if our citizens are able to, in the initiative process, repeal existing law and enact new law in the same process. So in other words, if repeal's involved, is it already covered under this? I guess that's possible.
Yeah, boy, I don't even want to speculate on that, honestly. I feel like I'm out over my skis on that question. Hard to know, although whoever said it, this issue on severability wouldn't come into play there. You know, this is focused on a very unique situation, which is where citizens are making law, and it's focused on really the policy issues of the citizens making that law and then the role of the legislature in reviewing that. And so that is unique to initiatives.
Okay. Thank you. And my question was more to just know the process and to solve my to satisfy my curiosity about that, because I'm familiar with repealing, I'm familiar with enacting. I just didn't know if it could be done in one fell swoop. So are there any questions for the sponsor or for Mr. Felspad? Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, I support this bill. We've seen folks, well, through the last initiative, and this is not a partisan issue for me. There have been issues with initiatives from the right, initiatives from the left. But the last one encouraged folks that are thinking about initiative to shoot for the moon. Let the court sort it out. So it sort of takes the pressure away about the intent of the initiative process. I think it by not being able to sever the issues they collected, if my name were on an initiative and it were changed that dramatically, I would want to have to give my name a second time. And this corrects a lot of the problems that have been really ineffective about the initiative process in other states. I think it's a great bill, and I support it.
Yes, and I do too. And it makes me think of the public trust factor. You know, you sign it thinking that's how it's going to stay. If we were to sign a contract and then the language of the contract changed, I mean, we all know that's not the right thing to do. So I think it is in alignment with this as well. And Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess first of a couple questions to the sponsor would be, a provision like this has the potential, I think, to serve as an incentive to sue over any and every initiative. Because if you can nick it, if you can just wound it the tiniest bit, the whole thing's off the ballot. Had you thought through the implications of this on sort of our overly litigious society already? Are we going to have a lawsuit over every initiative that gets filed?
Thank you, Senator, through the chair. You know, I don't think so. I think this is a fairly, hopefully it's not a common practice where the courts dive in and rewrite an initiative that is, in the instance was mentioned earlier, I mean, it's a very long initiative. It was changed by the courts and substantially changed by the courts. And the presumption would be that the public that is asked to sign or to petition their government would not see significant changes in that in that document when it shows up in the ballot.
Senator Keel,
thank you, Madam Chair, to the sponsor. So I think the Alaska courts first severed part of an initiative in the end of the 80s, wasn't it? I think Lieutenant Governor McAlpine's name was on that case. Is it your sense that the voters haven't been able to assess initiatives in any of the petitions they've signed between now and then? I mean, what's changed in the intervening years since this was done in the late 80s?
It would be, through the chair, it would be my assessment that initiatives are overly complex. They are overreaching. I think there's been some testimony to that effect. And the net result is that you have initiatives put in front of the public that that we hadn't seen before, that haven't gone through the deliberative process of law. The presumption would be that when it goes to when it's initially certified by the lieutenant governor, that it has gone through a legal review and it is appropriate to be out in front of the public.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, can you talk about the Article 12, Section 11 issue, where the Constitution says, unless clearly inapplicable, the lawmaking powers assigned to the legislature may be exercised by the people through the initiative? My sense is that that is a real bar to the legislature putting additional burdens on the initiative power that we don't have on our lawmaking power. Can you help me think that through?
Senator Keel, through the chair, as the engineer in the room and not the attorney in the room, if it would be possible, I'd like to punt that to Mr. Felsett.
Mr. Felsett, did you hear the question, or would you like it repeated?
Chair, I heard it. Happy to take it. So with the initiative process, there are a number of constitutional provisions in play. So I'm not going to say there's just one that governs this. Anytime there's a change like this, there are constitutional kind of repercussions. So the Senator Bekele, the provision you just mentioned, is in play. But it's, I think on the other side of it is one that is equally powerful, if not more, which is that Senator Birch mentioned at the outset, which is the constitutional right, call it the obligation for the legislature to review an initiative before it goes to the voters. And to me, this is actually the most powerful really issue in play here. And I really do believe it's apolitical. This doesn't favor a particular kind of position or issue. It's the role of the legislature, which is that the framers of the Constitution contemplated the legislature would really be the last stop with the ability to review an initiative and to enact something substantially similar if it chooses to do so, and that would stop the initiative. That's a pretty powerful combination. People have the right to make laws subject to the legislature bringing an end to that if they choose to do so. The dynamic with the courts and severance significantly changes that. And because if the court severs something, as it did last year on Proposition 1, that's something that is severed is very different than what the legislature looked at in the first instance. And it changes the politics. You can imagine if there's a bill that you look at that comes in, not a bill, an initiative, you look at it and say, you know, we don't like any part of this. The probability that the legislature enacts something substantially similar is probably low. Why would the legislature enact something similar to something it doesn't like? If the court severs the things that are objectionable, that's a very different piece of legislation. And the probability that the legislature would actually enact something substantially similar, I think goes way up. So that step matters. The positioning and the time at which a legislature looks at it matters. So putting the court after it and creating something different is really significant. And so those are the, long-winded answer, sorry, Senator Keel, but getting to the what I would call competing constitutional issues in play here.
Follow-up.
Senator Keel, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Felsett. I appreciate that. I mean, it seems to be analogous, though, to the governor's power to sign or veto, right? The legislature enacts something, and if the governor doesn't like it, he'll take one action. If he does like it, he'll take another action, but the court retains the ability to sever afterwards. So same dynamic in play. How then does that justify an additional restriction on the lawmaking power of the people through initiative?
I would say the people have the lawmaking power. They have the ability to make laws. The question is not what the people propose. So the people are coming and saying, we want this initiative. There's 10 parts to it. And I think that's fine. Everyone agrees kind of truth that in advertising is how this should work. It's where the courts say it's not going to be 10 parts. We're taking out two. And so the people wanted 10. The courts are deciding unilaterally, we think the people are okay with 8, not 10.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, respectfully, the people then decide whether they're okay with 8 or 10. They get the vote, but I will leave it there. Thank you.
Yeah, correct. They get to vote at the voting box, but you know, to me, the part of this that matters the most, using that analogy, is the legislature at the front of the process would say, we were presented with a bill with 10 parts. We chose to take a pass on it. After the legislature ends, the courts have their take at it. They carve out two. It's now a bill with 8 parts, and the legislature has not looked at that, and it could be a very different bill.
Okay, thank you. Does the sponsor have anything you'd like to add?
I just want to thank the committee for taking this up this evening and giving us consideration. I think it's a relatively short bill, but it certainly has some, in my view, some significant benefit and consequence and potential for actually you know, streamlining our process here. And I want to thank Kim Skipper for all her help and assistance in carrying this forward, too.
Ms. Skipper, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Not a thing. Thank you.
And Senator Michicki?
I just have a suggestion that folks, whether you know it or not, the Constitution is here with a lot of different precedent. There's some interesting pieces on that right here in this little blue book in the Title I section on initiatives, and it answers a couple of those questions. But I think we've discussed it enough. I think I've stated my support for the bill. The reality of it is a truth in advertising thing. If I put my signature on something, it better be what's going forward, and if not, it should come back for a new set of signatures, and I think that's all you're asking. So I think that's a good approach.
Thank you very much for the time again this evening, and thank you, Mr. Felstad, for being available this evening for the committee discussion.
Yes, and I'll, this is not a direct analogy, but I know it's happened before where we as a legislator might sign on to a bill, and then the bill drastically changes, mm-hmm. and then we need to pull our name off. Mm-hmm. So I do appreciate you bringing this forward, and I support it as well. And so with that, thank you very much, and I want to let folks know that we will set this bill aside and we will bring it back, I believe, tomorrow. Double check with us, and because I believe we're going to do public testimony so that then we'll be able to move it out. And so if members have any amendments, that'll be based on whether we'll be able to, how soon we'll be able to move it out. I would like to make the request for amendments by Wednesday at noon, but if members would like that change to Thursday noon, would you please let indicate now? Okay, then we will put the amendment deadline Wednesday noon, and then we will take it up tomorrow for public testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we have one final item on our agenda, and that is some follow-up information on SB 52. Senator Michicki is our sponsor. Come on up, Ms. Morledge. The request was to get a walkthrough of the changes that were done in the Labor and Commerce Committee. So if you would please walk us through that, and then we'll take questions and hopefully wrap up and be done before too long this evening. Senator Reinbold? We're going to take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Welcome, Ms. Morledge. Please walk us through the changes and indicate which versions, too, just so we're all up on the same page.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Machicki. And we are on version of Senate Bill 5231-LS004-S. It is the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute. So before you, you should have a list with the explanation of changes. And all but the last two pertain to Section 10, which is the licensing section. The first change is to manufacture, well, the first two actually, are to the manufacturing licensing section for breweries and wineries. And it's making the same change to both of those. So the first one for breweries is on page 6, lines 13 to 15. The change requires that the fermentation process of all brewed beverages offered for sale for a brewery manufacturer licensee to occur on the holder's premises in the state. This is a change from the previous version where it required 80% of their final product be manufactured on site. The same change is made for the winery manufacturer license, which is on page 6, lines 20 to 21. The third and fourth changes are also very similar for breweries and wineries. This is also, again, in Section 10. It pertains, the first, number three pertains to brewery retail licenses, and number four, the winery retail licenses. The brewery part is beginning on page 22, lines 8 to 10. This clarifies that brewery retail license holders can sell up to 5.167 gallons of the holder's beer or sake for consumption off the premises. The only change here is including sake in that. We don't actually currently have any sake manufacturers in state, but just in case that were ever something somebody would like to pursue, we felt that they should all be treated similar. The fourth change to the winery retail license is on page 23, lines 9 through 11, and this clarifies that that same limit, the 5.167 gallons of the holder's wine, mead, or cider, can be sold for consumption off of the premises.
Madam Chair, quick question.
Senator Keel.
I appreciate that we got away from sort of the alcohol differentiation within wine versus cider, whatever. We ended up, I think, doubling the amount of wine that could be sold. Can you just walk me through that piece?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Keel, in current statute, both breweries and wineries can sell up to 5 gallons. So it's not a large departure from what is in current law. The original version of this bill had changed it to 9 liters. So we heard from some wineries in the previous committee that was really going to hit their bottom line negatively. So, and it is actually occurring across the country that wineries are selling kegs of wine now for special functions and events and things like that. So we made that change.
Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. Chair Hughes, that ended up being my amendment. It was to match conforming language to match both sections of the law. In addition, we heard like people wanted to have a wedding, for example, and they were being dramatically limited, you know, by the 9 liters. So that's the reason. So that was definitely something that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, Edra Morledge. I believe that brings us to the fifth one. Again, Section 10, this is actually a removal, so you will not see it on any lines in your pages, but what we took out from the previous version was the prohibition for manufacturer sampling license holders to advertise sampling activities on their premises. That was, again, at the request of a winery who felt that not being able to advertise to consumers, especially in the summertime with seasonal visitors, to come to their premises and hopefully then purchase their products, that would have a negative impact on their business. the sixth one down, and I apologize for not numbering these, but this begins on page 33, lines 23 to 24. This is the pertains to the large resort endorsement, and this simply clarifies that consumption of alcoholic beverages on a large resort is permitted whether or not the locations are in the same building or under the same roof of the large resort. This allows customers of, say, a large resort in the state to be out at a particular bonfire area and be able to carry their own glass of wine to a different area of the same resort on the same property, rather than have to have a server come and carry the alcohol for them. It's not a large departure from what was in the previous version. This just makes that very clear. And the second to last change, beginning on page 55, line 22 to page 56, line 10. This is section 27. This is application for transfer of a license to another person. What this does is it adds a new section that allows the automatic transfer of a license to another person, not another location, if no action has been taken by the board within 60 days. This applies to a restaurant and eating place license with or without endorsements and seasonal restaurant or eating place tourism license with or without endorsements. And the last change, Madam Chair, is section 45, page 65, line 30 to page 66, line 2. This is regarding conditions or restrictions. And this changes the authority to impose conditions or restrictions on a permit, aside from a conditional contractor's permit, from the previous version, which allowed the director that authority to change it to the board having that authority.
I have a question about the second to the last change in section 27 being automatic. Was there a problem with things being backlogged and then the event would come and go, or what was the reason for that?
Madam Chair, I can take that.
Senator Michicki?
There has been some problems on the transfer of ownership when people buy a new restaurant or eating place. But as we look at this section, it actually causes some problems on the timing. It gets in the way of the local government's opportunity, and this is something we're probably going to have to look at. And this was not from the chair of Labor and Commerce. He did an excellent job on this bill. It was these last two amendments were by another member, but and I actually support what she's trying to do. I just don't think we got it quite right, so we have some work to do on that section, as well as the next section. The next section changes the authority. Did you start on this already?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The on that page 65, line 30 to page 66, line 2, the idea of the amendment was to not give the director the opportunity to make the changes that only the board could. So right now the director's kind of an up or down vote. She can't put conditions on it until the board meets. The board can put conditions. So I think people are reading it like the conditions are negative. But the reality of this, the conditions are positive. If we go about it this way, it's going to slow down the ability for people that have a minor problem on their application, where the condition could be return this application to me with these two extra things, or do this one thing, and if you could do it, I can approve your license or permit. In this case, on a permit, the event might be long over before the board meets. So it's again, I understand the desire of these two. I think we're going to have to work on making it actually function.
Okay. Do you have anything to add, Ms. Morledge?
I don't.
Okay. Are there any questions? Was that helpful to you, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. All right. Well, thank you for being with us again this evening. So I'm not seeing any other questions or comments. So we are going to set this bill aside. Senator Michicki does have a comment.
Yeah, it'll be quick. I want to thank the prior committee and the committee chair, who happens to be on this committee, for again, it's a big bill because of all of the reordered stuff, but I think they tackled it rather quickly and made some really important changes to it. We have a couple to work on, but that's a minor thing.
And I will just say I am glad that you are carrying this bill, Senator Machicki, and I am not. Senator Reinbold.
Well, I want to say, Senator Machicki, I think it's 7 years you've been working on this. Is that, do I have the timeline right there?
Six or seven.
Anyway, so they're the most organized I've ever seen. And I will tell you, yes, it was a massive heavy lift for Labor and Commerce, but you guys made it, you know, really workable. We worked, the staff worked really well. The committee worked really well. We all pulled together. We stirred up all the opposition. We let it float to the top. We dealt with one opposition at a time and really heard them out. So we did a humongous, you know, justice to this bill, I think. And that's why I think it's so close to being ready. I think we left a couple things from Department of Law because we thought it was the most appropriate to address in this committee. So I do have two amendments that I'm working with the sponsor and Department of Law on. We're going to meet, but those two, and then one on a winery issue that we didn't quite get right in regards to licensure. And that's the only thing I can think of because we dealt with so many huge issues. But anyway, it was really an incredible task and a good one and an important one. And I'm very, very supportive of this bill. I became a believer. So.
Well, in addition to being grateful that Senator Machicki is carrying it, and I'm not, I'm very grateful that you did the work in your committee and didn't leave it for this committee. So we like that. And as far as those changes, we would like to have the amendments to my office by Thursday noon, if possible. And we're happy to work with all of you on those. So we're ready to set this bill aside now for this evening. And with that, are there any closing comments? Well, then we shall adjourn at 7:02, a little earlier than last night.